accommodation, Your Honor. It was
very bad.
Bad weather.
Bad traffic and accidents.
I'm sure.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
All right.
Good morning. My name is Elena Garella. I represent the appellant, Michelle Merceri, who is in the court today. Michelle Merceri came to the trial court with a very difficult problem. She had purchased a home in 2006, and in purchasing the home, her friend, the respondent, Mr. Jones, agreed to be on the loan documents in exchange for a one-time payment of $15,000, which he was paid. And the original conception of this deal is that Michelle would live there for a while, use money that came out of the loan for construction, turn around and sell it. As we all know, the recession interfered and things went downhill. The value of the house went downhill, the ability of her to pay the mortgage went downhill, and the two former friends became quite bitterly opposed to each other. The real situation that confronted both of them was that Ms. Merceri, could not refinance or sell the home without Jones's assistance or cooperation because he was on title. At the same time, Jones was burdened by a potential $2.8 million debt that he couldn't get out of unless the home were refinanced or sold. So both of them were stuck in the situation together. And as the trial court found, efforts to resolve this didn't work for years. So in 2013...
Well, the trial court found that Jones didn't do anything to interfere with your client's efforts to either sell or refinance.
The trial court found, first, that they had been unsuccessful in resolving it, and second, the trial court made a specific finding that Jones was willing to cooperate with efforts upon a payment of $140,000 for an unrelated debt.
The court found that was a settlement. At trial, the court also found, and I think your client can acknowledge this in testimony, that she could not identify any instance in which Mr. Jones interfered with either a sale or a refinance.
My client...
And you haven't challenged and made argument that there is insufficient evidence in the record to support that finding.
Excuse me, Your Honor. There are a number of specific statements in the record. As I said, he demanded $140,000 on an unrelated debt. That's an interference. The court itself found that they had been unable to resolve the problem.
Let's focus on finding number 12, since you don't seem to agree with my representation of the record. Finding 12, Jones never caused the failure of any refinance of the loan. Is there sufficient evidence in the record to support that finding?
The reason that finding was made
My question is, is there sufficient evidence in the record to support that finding?
The finding is supported by the fact that Merceri did not respond to requests for admissions. The court found it as that because it had been admitted.
As a matter of law in Washington jurisprudence, is that sufficient?
Yes, that's sufficient. However,
now let me go to the next one. Jones never caused the failure of any sale of the property. That also was the result of your client's failure to respond to requests for admissions. Is that correct?
Correct.
And is that sufficient as a matter of law to support that finding?
It is.
Aren't you stuck with both of those findings as you stand before us?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the fact is that the entire record as a whole shows that these two people are unable to resolve the situation, which is exactly why they went to the trial court. The fact that the realistic fact, as opposed to the fact that was made through admissions, is that the two people, as the trial court itself states in other findings that are somewhat inconsistent with this reasoning, Mr. Jones wanted extra money. The trial court found over and over again that the two didn't trust each other and there was reasons for it, that they couldn't cooperate. In other words, the fact is evident on the ground that these two people can't get out of the situation that they've been in since 2005.
What's the rule of law that says if two people voluntarily put themselves in an untenable position that the court will rescue?
The rule of law is not a matter of rescue. The rule of law is that it's the duty of the court when people come to them with a situation, a real property mess, as these people had, that it will do its best to exercise equity, sometimes creatively, to resolve the situation rather than relieving them. There was no finding of unkind.
What case do you rely upon for that proposition?
Okay. There's Blanchard versus Golden Age Brewing Company. There's Orwick versus City of Seattle. There are large numbers of cases that recognize the express duty of a court sitting in equity to resolve continuing problems. The problem here is exactly that. The trial court recognized an untenable situation and left them in the situation that they were in. And whether or not equitable relief is available is a question of law. The trial court, I believe, erred when it left these people in the same situation they had been in for several years and will be in for about another 20 years when the mortgage becomes due.
Well, that raises another question. There's interest-only payments due on this mortgage during those 20 years?
Yes.
Have they been made?
They have not been made since approximately 2008.
So the bank could foreclose now, had it the will to do so?
It could foreclose. There have been negotiations about refinance.
Thank you, Ms. Girl.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I am Alan Bornstein. My partner, Matt Adamson, who signed the brief and prepared it, is in a jury trial with Judge Zille, so I'm happy to substitute for him today since he can't be in two places at one time. The untenable situation that opposing counsel refers to was one created by them. They chose a cause of action and lost badly. And Judge Halpert, after patiently listening to baseless litigation and baseless tactics, which I'm about to describe, awarded sanctions of $20,000. This appeal is nothing more than the next chapter in the continuation of plaintiffs' bad faith claims. Let me address them.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
What are we to make of the fact that in a separate lawsuit in which your client obtained affirmative relief, your client represented that his signature on the loan documents was forged?
It was, but he was still on title. And the nature of that lawsuit was his exposure to an additional loan obligation. He thought it was a $2,400 loan, and when he saw the loan documents, he discovered it was a forgery by plaintiff. There's a $2,800 loan, so it was a $400,000 difference.
Well, let me, normally if your signature's forged on an instrument, you can get relief from liability on the instrument. Why isn't that the appropriate relief? If that was really the state of affairs,
that was the plaintiff's choice.
No, your client's choice. I mean, he's here telling us he's got over $2 million worth of exposure. Is he not claiming that the documents that created $2 million worth of exposure had a forged signature? Is it something different?
What he's claiming is it was a valid. The loan amount, the signature was false, but the loan amount and his entitlement to be on the deed was legitimate for a $2.4 million debt. So he thought he was the owner. He discovers this after the fact that the loan amount is greater. But
so it's the cushion between what the original sales price actually was and what was represented at closing to the lender? Is that?
Yes. And so that's an in personam obligation. Before this court is an in rem obligation involving slander of title, which was baseless because we don't even have a slander. There's no title defect created by Jones. Secondarily, for quiet title, we have loud character assassination, but they're remarkably tranquil when it comes to their superior title. There was none. That's why Judge Halpert found that it was baseless.
The argument courts generally don't leave people in a big mess they can't solve for themselves. And that's not quite how it's elegantly worded in the briefing, but I think that's the gist of it.
Well, the mess that's created by them was through fraud. My client's still on the hook, and the court is not a nanny.
That's the point that she's making, is that this real estate transaction, as contemplated by your client, still had them both involved for a very large loan, and there was an anticipation that she'd be able to improve the property and flip it, and she'd make some money. He got his $15,000, and he wouldn't have ongoing liability. Things didn't work out that way because of things beyond both of their control, economic consequences of the collapse of the banking market, and she's looking for some help.
She's looking for some help. She created a fraudulent loan and then loaded up another $750,000 of debt. She talk about dirty hands. These are filthy hands. She's not entitled to equity. This is a fraud. And so for her to say it's untenable, a mess of her own making, if the bank wishes to foreclose, which it may, then that solves the problem for both clients. They may be liable, or if it's a non-judicial foreclosure, then there's no deficiency judgment to my client, which is why he has to
see. Judicial foreclosure, there could well be a significant.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So absolutely. Do you think that's the most likely next development, or are there other options that you can see as possibilities for
partition,
extricating the parties from this?
I mean, here's the irony. Now, we have not come to the court seeking. This was solely the opposing party seeking judicial relief. We were dragged in. But if you're asking for ideas.
As defendants, you mean?
As defendants, that's correct. But, I mean, I'll tell you why they never sought a partition, which is inconsistent with the action in the case before you. A partition, you join all the parties, all the necessary parties, in an action. It's an interim action, so it would involve the lender, which would necessarily involve Wells Fargo, who wants to grab the condemnation proceeds, because that's an interest in property. It's derived from a forced sale of a property by a sovereign. And so that would cause the money from the condemnation to go to Wells Fargo.
Well, doesn't the trust have a provision that addresses what happens to condemnation?
Absolutely. So if the parties really want.
You would need a partition action for the lender to enforce whatever rights it has to the condemnation action.
But the question, you were correct, but the question posed to me, what would my solution be? So I'm saying potentially, when what
Well, a partition sale, since this property doesn't appear to be divisible, would simply result in a forced sale analogous to the trustee sale only conducted by the sheriff.
That's right. But that's separate to the parties, to address your question. I think given the economic nature here of fraudulent loans, that's probably the best that one can get. But the case before you is the case that they brought, which was not for partition. They wanted my client off title so they could grab those $350,000 of condemnation proceeds. Even though we're a co-obligor, they never bothered to tell us about it. We discovered it later.
The condemnation?
Yes. Yes. 520.
And those proceeds are where right now?
I they're either held by the state or they may be, I don't know.
That's a good enough answer.
Yes. Yes. I know that they exist. I just can't tell you where they're located. So
the condemnation has wrapped up. It's done. Is that what you're saying?
The question for the condemnation, yes, I believe so. The question for condemnation is who gets the money?
Yeah.
My client obviously wants the money to go to the bank because it diminishes his liability by $350,000. That's why he wants to stay on title. That's why she wanted him, my client, off title so she could grab the money. She didn't tell Wells Fargo, the bank, about the condemnation either. They found out later through us.
Well, wouldn't they need to find out for the bank to acquire title? Not the bank, excuse me, the Department of Transportation. I mean.
Ultimately, unless she would mischaracterize it as personal property.
Well, I'm thinking, my experience with condemnation actions is that the agency condemning gets a litigation guarantee and sees whatever interest in the property exists and joins those properties.
Right. My understanding is it's an inverse condemnation case, so I think at the end of the day, you are correct versus a traditional condemnation where the party's interests were named. So this is the twist.
So is there a lawsuit involved in this inverse condemnation, or was this simply a claim made in a settlement?
I believe it was a negotiated settlement without ours and the bank's involvement. Also related to this case I wouldn't say it's a matter of decorum, but I don't think that lawyers and their litigants are above the law. I mean, 40 years ago, we had a president who wasn't above the law and had to endure the consequences of his action. I think, in addition to the bad faith baseless litigation involving slander of title where there is no slander, and a quiet title action where there's mere quiescence and silence, you don't, as a litigant and as an attorney, get to file a motion on one day's notice, one, to disqualify the lawyer, two, to get a default judgment on the quiet title action based, there's a logic gap here, based on the failure to alleged failure, which is false, alleged failure to produce documents in a slander of title action, which was dismissed a month before. And then you rely, really, your basis for that whole motion, that egregious motion, is to call my partner a tool who's engaged in harassment and abuse of a non-intimate partner? That's absolutely ridiculous. It's scurrilous.
There's a judicial estoppel argument that has been brought here.
Right, and we addressed it, but I'm happy to address your questions, too.
My question is, you think that that is not debatable?
It's not debatable at all, because one, it's an in personam action where my client said, I am on title and there is a loan, and I'm seeking the delta between roughly, I'm using round numbers here, between $2.8 and $2.4 million, versus this action where he says, look, I'm on the hook as an obligor. So one, I'm still an owner, like he said in the other action, and two, I'm on the loan. And I have an interest in this line. So they're different actions. The court called their arguments illogical in the first place. We're seeking the delta of potential exposure. But it doesn't negate the fact that, one, we're an owner, we didn't slander the title, and if you remove us from title, then we're exposed because we can't trust them on, under this cockamamie quitclaim deed at the last moment, where we're going to rely upon her good judgment and discretion to negotiate the terms of relief, where we have tax and contract liability. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
The spring and quitclaim deed offer that was made first in November of 2013 and then in post-trial argument, but before trial had been decided, wouldn't leave anything to my client's judgment. The idea was that once some sort of settlement or refinance or sale occurred in which the loan was paid off, the quitclaim deed that had already been signed by Jones would be filed.
Do you agree that resolution was first proposed in closing argument?
No. It was proposed in November of 2013. That's in my brief. It was discussed in front of Judge Downing, and that's in the record of proceedings. It was not first proposed then, and it
when
wouldn't
you say
even
discussed, was it in a pleading?
It was not in a pleading. It was an oral colloquy. I believe there were also letters that went back and forth.
Do you maintain that your client is entitled to this springing deed relief?
No.
As a matter, let me finish my question, please. As a matter of law?
No. She's entitled.
How does the trial court abuse its discretion by saying that the circumstances don't warrant that relief?
It does not abuse its discretion in deciding that it doesn't warrant that particular relief. It abuses its discretion by not applying any equitable relief at all to the situation, by determining that equitable relief isn't available.
Counsel's argument is that, well, you chose the particular kind of lawsuit that you filed, and the trial court concluded that you weren't entitled to that relief, and he's just pointing out this morning that there may be a couple of other things that could happen here.
We have notice pleading in the state.
It seems like your argument is, the gist of your argument is, this is the only possible thing that could have happened that would have gotten these people disentangled from each other, and the court just threw up its hands and refused to consider it.
We asked for equitable relief. The court could have made any number of decisions in equitable relief, and they're listed in my appellate brief. Could have considered a receivership, could have considered instructions to the parties on exactly how to handle it, could have appointed a court-appointed realtor.
Were those solutions proposed to the trial court in a pleading?
They were not, but I'm not aware in a notice pleading state that we have that obligation.
Is it your position that trial courts have the obligation, when parties don't ask for relief, to try and imagine some relief that would provide a solution?
The court would be obligated to say, I need to impose some equitable relief here and perhaps ask the parties to assist. But the court simply decided here that equitable relief wasn't available. I do want to address a couple specific things. His statement about the judicial estoppel argument is incorrect. He asked in the previous lawsuit for $2 million.
But he also said the $2 million was the delta between the anticipated sale price of the property and the total amount owed the bank. he always maintained that the equity in the property would be applied to the loan and only sought to recover from the defendants in that case the difference between the equity in the property and the total amount that he took.
Now, if you look at the Avista pleadings.
I have his declaration here. We can go through it the same way we went through the findings, but it's abundantly clear that he subtracts from the total amount the value of the property. I can hold it up and show you if you want.
It's
really
abundantly clear in the declaration. If you look back at the Avista pleadings, you see that in the default findings, he got the full amount of the loan, about $2 million, and
that
then he got the same relief
here.
That isn't
the owed the bank any longer. His pleadings demonstrate that there are also interest on the loan.
I want to point out here that he mentioned fraud a number of times. There was no finding of fraud against my client in this case, no findings of impari delicto. Those kinds of allegations simply smear my client in a case in which these two obviously have serious problems that should have been addressed. Thank you.
All right.
Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looks like our next case now is going to be State versus Kaiser.